It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 89 for Friday, the 17th of August, 2012. This week, can your phone predict where you'll be by analysing where your friends are? One university just won an award for claiming to be able to do just that. Plus, Bill Gates has awarded a significant amount of money to a team of engineers who have reinvented the toilet in order to get better sanitation facilities into the developing world. And we've finally done it. Humans have created the hottest heat ever. A plasma measuring around 5.5 trillion degrees Kelvin. All that and more as we burn our way through this week's blast doors of Wired News. Ahoy, hoy, I'm Nate Langston. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, news editor Duncan of Gear.
Hello.
And, of course, our associate editor, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
We're going to start off with a bit of housekeeping, which is fitting since we're in the Easy Living Trinket Cupboard. We have some news, don't we, Duncan?
We have some news.
We have some news that I've filed under SAD.
Yes.
Duncan.
Do you want to tell people what the news is?
The news is that as of 2 weeks' time, Duncan is leaving.
Leaving.
Duncan is leaving Wired.
As of one podcast time.
He is.
I've only got one more left after this one.
Duncan, where are you going?
I'm going to Sweden, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to study a master's degree and go freelance. It's going to be very exciting.
We still expect to hear from you on the website.
I hope so. I would love to still contribute, definitely.
Well, we still have two portions of gear left in our lives.
Should we serve those up?
The good stuff as well.
Yeah, we've got two quality samples of Duncan to put into your ears over the next couple of weeks. Anyway, we're going to start, though, by talking about Google, not Duncan, which has downranked sites accused of infringing copyright, Liv.
Yes, this is an update that Google's made to its search algorithm to try and push down copyright infringing websites in the results. So at the moment, anyone can file a complaint of copyright infringement to Google. I think they got about 4.4 million of these in the last month. But now they're going to actually downrank those websites that get a lot of these requests.
This isn't the first time Google's been sort of tampering with search results at the request of, you know, various different officials. They've had lines in the search results that say certain results in this list have been removed because of DMCA takedown notices.
Yeah.
And now they're actually de-ranking the entire site.
Yes, exactly. And they named a couple of big offenders, including FilesTube and TorrentHound. So these are likely to be potentially pushed down the rankings. So the idea is that when you're looking for a movie or a piece of music, you're more likely to see an official source for that movie versus an unofficial one.
So how is this going to affect the kind of Google-owned sites that get a lot of copyright notices, things like YouTube and Blogger or Blogspot?
According to Google, they'll be treated in the same way in terms of the number of removal notices, but at the same time, they're trying to keep user-generated content sites from not just automatically being pushed down because they share so much content. But they haven't actually been clear about how they're going to balance these two things. So on one hand, it gets loads and loads of takedown notices. But then on the other hand, they can't really be responsible because users are uploading them and there's this kind of protection that they have.
I think it's a double standard. I think if Google's delisting sites because of massive amounts of takedown notices, it should be flagging down YouTube. YouTube should be appearing lower in the results, I think.
I guess the problem is there that they're kind of protected in a certain way by the DMCA, aren't they?
But these other sites are protected under the DMCA. I mean, the DMCA says that, you know, if they issue a takedown request, you know, they have to honour that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think FilesTube has things taken down. You know, if you go and do a search for a popular band or something, you'll often see, you know, removed at the request of such and such.
I think the point here is that this is actually only going to be one factor. There's you know, hundreds of different factors that affect where a site appears on a results list, and this is just going to be one of them. And so things like YouTube rank so highly in all the other factors that something that just tweaking this particular aspect down a bit probably isn't going to have that much effect.
Okay. Do you think, I mean, I heard that the MPAA isn't actually very happy with this anyway.
Yeah, they've come out and they've commended Google for doing this. This is the Motion Picture Association of America and also the Recording Industry Association of America, RIAA. They both said, oh, yes, this is a good step in the right direction, but we still think Google should be doing much more. So I don't know what it takes to please these guys. But,
I mean, almost certainly. So the background to this is, of course, that Google is trying to launch its own music stuff and it wants to license that. And so it wants to be able to do deals with the music companies. So this is almost certainly an olive branch of some sort in that direction to try and sweeten the terms so that they get a better deal.
I think Google's doing it wrong. I don't think they should be tampering with these in this way. I think that Google is not in the business traditionally of serving up content. You know, when it starts selling music and videos, and you know, if you're right, and if this observation that, you know, they're starting to do these takedowns and de-links, de-ranking and things is connected to the fact that they want to be effectively competing with those sites, I think that's a
no. But there's a difference between a site that's posting pirated
legal and illegal competition.
Yeah, and I think they do have some responsibility to kind of prevent.
But Google's not a content company. You know, Google's...
It's not, but it's the biggest kind of pointer towards content companies. Hmm.
And also, I'd say that this is kind of... Like almost every other anti-piracy measure, this is going to have a negligible effect on any kind of pirate traffic. You know, if you want a torrent for a film, you're going to find a torrent for a film, whether they do this or not.
And whether they're in the first results or, first page of results or not.
Well, if you are torrenting films in the UK, you've probably been noticing that they have been downloading faster. Is that not right, Duncan?
Over the last couple of years, that's right. The average UK broadband speeds have risen in the past year to 9 megabits a second, which isn't actually that bad. I was quite impressed by that.
Mine's 100 at home.
We can all talk about the size of our pipe.
I look down on people with 9 megabits. It's pathetic, but it is better than it was last year, which was about 7, I think we reported, or something
like that. Yeah. Well, what's most impressive is that it's more than doubled in the last 4 years, thanks to the rollout of super fast fiber optic broadband from people like Virgin and BT Infinity, and I can't remember what the Virgin one's called, XXXXL or something, isn't it?
XXL, I think.
Yeah. They have very much pushed the average up. And so while not a huge amount of the population can get those, it kind of brings up the average significantly.
It'd be interesting to see what change there's been if you kind of remove those from the equation, if there has been any change at all.
Well, there has been an effect. Now 68% of the population has apparently got access to speeds greater than 10 megabits a second, as in they can buy internet that's that fast.
And that's really good. I mean, the government still thinks that 2 megabits is the minimum speed that everyone should have access to. As part of the copyright bill, wasn't it? Digital Millennium. It was part of that review that 2 megabits was the minimum, I think.
Yeah.
Last year or year before. But what I find more interesting, though, is when people start doing these sorts of measurements for minimum, sort of the average 3G speeds, because although people say, 3G, HSDPA, whatever, is up to 14.4 megabits, that's so massively variable because of, network congestion and your location, your signal strength and stuff like that. It'd be very interesting maybe next year to sort of see how 3G speeds have been comparing.
Yeah, because they're rising fast as well as we get kind of more 3G, and increasingly, 4G testing is starting to happen now across the UK. But if you're sat there and you're wondering at the moment between whether you should go for BT Infinity or Virgin Superfast XXXXL or whatever it's called, then you might find this next bit interesting. Virgin won the fastest broadband prize. They hit 88.3 megabits per second over a 24-hour period, which is pretty fast.
Still not as fast as mine.
But BT actually won the fastest upload speeds.
Oh, what's their upload?
14.6 megabit.
That is faster than mine.
Yeah.
So, well, I don't think
depending on how much you want to upload or download, then decide accordingly.
Okay. Well, we're going to leave the sort of tech and move into toilets. A year ago, and I think we talked about this on the show, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation launched a $42 million initiative to effectively reinvent the toilet so the developing world could have access to clean sanitation. And this week, they announced that a solar-powered chemical toilet has won £64,000 at a toilet fair held at the foundation's Seattle headquarters.
Hold up a second. A toilet fair?
Well, yeah. It's where they were showing off various different designs and ideas that most of the universities had come up with, and, you know, new ways of dealing with waste.
I've got an image in my head a bit like a kind of school fete where there's like bunting
it's
everywhere and
like
there's
that.
Just toilets.
It's apple bobbing, but from the bowl.
And please, we don't need to know what the apple was. But the initial challenges were set to universities and designers, and they had to make a toilet that operated without running water, without electricity, or a septic system, which obviously is quite a challenge. And it all has to be for around 3 pence a day per person at the sort of the effective cost. So Caltech came up with the winning design, which earned it the £64,000 in prize money. And there were a couple of others that are quite notable we got here. The University of Loughborough came second with, they won £38,000 for a toilet that converts fecal matter into charcoal.
Ooh,
which
that's
I think
useful.
That's awesome.
Didn't you did an article called 5 ways to process your poo?
I did indeed.
And I think that might have been one of them.
A proud moment. Yes.
In your journalistic career.
It was up there. Also Lou Watt was another one I wrote about where they turned it into biogas.
You've done a lot of stories about poo in
I
your time.
I have.
The University of Toronto had one that used dehydration and low temperature combustion to treat waste, basically dry it out and burn it up.
And so we haven't actually explained the reason why this challenge was set was because there's a huge number of people in the world who don't have access to running water. And
that's true. And about 1.5 million children die every year as a result of diarrhea and related illnesses.
So having improved sanitation would obviously decrease that number, hopefully.
Yeah. Bill Gates actually has been, well, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been spending £51 million a year on water sanitation and hygiene issues. It's right up there as a goal.
So is this toilet going to be rolled out then?
I don't know if that was an intended pun, but
no, it wasn't.
Basically,
but
the £64,000 that they've won is going to go towards developing the design that they've made. At the moment, it costs about £637 per toilet, which is much
more
too expensive
than your regular toilet. But
it's quite pricey, so they need to bring down the cost, and that's what they're going to use the money for. So hopefully, this time next year, we'll have some even better rollout news to report. Who knows? Anyway. Duncan, heat, get me hot,
get you hot. Then go to CERN. They've managed to break the man-made temperature record, so they have created the hottest heat that humans have ever made.
How hot are we talking? I mean, I know because I read it in my intro.
We're talking about 5.5 trillion degrees Kelvin, which is kind of the temperature of the universe a few hundred microseconds after the Big Bang.
I know that the other day they reported the hottest rain ever was like 46 degrees.
Yes.
It's hotter than that, right?
Yes, that would be Celsius. So on this scale, it would be 310 or something like 320 degree rain. We're talking 5.5 trillion degrees. So it's slightly different.
It's warm, isn't it, Liv?
How do they make this hot
heat?
Hot heat.
Basically by bashing lead ions together.
Oh. Heavy ions then.
Yes, yeah, but like what they were doing is they were using the particle accelerator at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, to bash these lead ions together. And when they do that for a split second, it creates this thing called a quark gluon plasma. Now, these are kind of like this is a really weird substance. You've heard of solid, liquid and gas.
Oh, I've heard of them. I've
You've heard of them. Well, there are other kind of like states of matter as well, and a quark gluon plasma is one of these things. They in these plasmas, the particles that make up matter are kind of temporarily freed of the nuclear force that holds them together, the bit that holds that holds the bits that make up a proton together, the whole bits that hold a neutron together. All those, that force, that incredibly strong force, which is the strongest force we know of in the universe, is released, and so they can kind of swim around each other and act very, very differently. They act like a kind of frictionless liquid, which is a very, very unusual property. And it's very unusual stuff. And we can only make it exist for like a microsecond or so. But to understand the early evolution of the universe, like what happened in those, you know, hundreds of milliseconds after the Big Bang occurred, we need to study this substance.
Wasn't this hotter than they did before? The last time was like 4 million or something.
4 trillion, yeah. 4 trillion degrees was set in I think it's in New York by a different lab. CERN knows that they've beat it by 38%, but they haven't officially got an exact temperature reading. They know it's going to be around 5.5 trillion, but they don't know exactly what it is. And they're going to be doing that over the next few weeks. They say it's a very difficult, a very delicate measurement. And
what is it that they use to measure this temperature?
Big thermometer. No, it's kind of about energy levels and and how fast the individual particles are moving within it.
Okay.
So the Higgs boson, the world's hottest heat.
Yeah.
Hot heat. Yeah. It's getting hot in here. Actually, it is getting hot in this room.
It is.
I'm sweating just thinking about all those Kelvins. let's move on then, shall we? Liv, you've been writing about drunken stargazing snakes and how it's killing our spineless friends.
They've got spines. They're all spine.
Well, you know what I mean.
They're nothing but spine.
Legless.
Legless. Yeah, they are legless.
They are legless. There we go.
So this is a story about microbiologists identifying a virus that causes a particularly unpleasant disease for snakes that makes them look like they're drunk or legless, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
This is a disease called inclusion body disease, and it's kind of baffled the scientific community for a while, but it's deadly at the moment. It kills off boa constrictors and it kills off pythons.
Is this the one that makes them chuck up their dinners?
Well, it does various things. It starts and they start throwing up, and snakes aren't big for puking usually.
No.
And then they start developing neurological problems. One of them is this stargazing symptom where they just stare up and into the sky for long periods of time. And then they also act drunk, as the people who observe them say. They actually tie themselves into knots that they then can't get out of. So there was an outbreak of this disease in the Steinhardt Aquarium in San Francisco, and there's no cure, but these guys decided to call upon the University of California to come and investigate. So the team of virologists came down, and they took samples from all of the snakes, and they did some DNA sequencing, and they discovered that within the snake DNA, there was this virus DNA. And not only did they identify this virus, but it seems to be a whole new class of virus altogether that's kind of vaguely related. It's vaguely related to Ebola, and it's from the arenavirus family. So it's particularly interesting because it shows that these viruses are actually... the similar ones only exist in mammals and I think like humans as well, such as meningitis, can actually exist in reptiles. And that could mean that they can provide clues as to how these diseases develop. Ah.
So there are, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are two types of kind of arena virus at the moment, aren't there? There's like old world and new world. Is that how it works?
Yes.
And then this is neither of those things. This is a completely new...
This is neither of those
newer
things.
World.
It's a completely new type one. And it's from snakes, which are more primitive creatures than the where the other viruses take hold. So that's why it's particularly interesting, and the virologists are really interested in what this can inform them about viruses and how they move into different kind of categories of animals.
So we don't have to worry about snake flu yet.
Oh
God, don't give the tabloids that.
It's only a matter of time.
So it hasn't helped the snakes, though. They all had to be euthanized. But in the long run, they might be able to develop some kind of vaccine, but not yet.
Snake vaccine.
Aw, poor little snakes. I mean, when I did hear about them acting drunk, I did sort of have this mental image of them like, all right, badger, you ain't all that, sort of slithering around, rolling over in circles.
Some people have tried to call it the mad snake disease, but I decided to avoid that... tabloid style headline.
Microsoft would be happy. The acronym there would be MSN. not so great. Anyway, we're going to slither.
No, it wouldn't. It'd be MSD.
We're going to slither into an ad break. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the world's teeniest little printer that automatically prints stuff off the internet for you. How bizarre.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Welcome back. Now, Duncan, you've been excited this week. I saw you hot and flustered, you were giddy, you were sweating.
That's a bit of an overstatement.
Feverish. Little printer came out that you could order that prints stuff.
Well, but it's not out yet. It's a pre-order. This is Berg's little printer, which was announced, when was it? Back last November, something like that?
Mm. Yeah.
And what it does is it's a tiny little thing that sits on your shelf. It's very cute. It hooks up to your Wi-Fi. It hooks up to kind of web-enabled services. There's all kinds of things you can kind of read with it. There's like news or pictures answers or puzzles or like little updates from your friends or messages from them or weather or like horoscopes, like all this kind of stuff.
You select podcasts?
Well, not on text. It's a printer.
We should transcribe our podcast.
But what it does is then every so often you hit a little button on the top and everything it's received since it last printed, it will print out in a little list that you can take with you. It's a dinky little thing. It's adorable. It's very cute. And it costs 200 quid.
200 British pounds.
200 British pounds.
Do you know what else you can buy for 200 quid? A lot of stuff.
Yeah, a lot of stuff.
That's an awful lot of money.
It's a really cute little device, but there's been a lot of kind of talk on Twitter about how basically, yeah, it's lovely, I'd love one, but not for 200 quid.
But it's more of a design kind of classic rather than, it's not like an actual kind of functional printer per se. It's more of a kind of present thing that you'd give people, and because it's Berg,
it's a toy almost. It's a design toy essentially. And as you say, because it's Berg, that's why it's probably got a massive price tag on it. Mm. But there are alternatives. Like Adafruit has got a little 3D printer thing that you can, sorry, not 3D printer, a 2D printer that you can build yourself, and that costs about 60 quid.
But it doesn't look as sweet and lovely as a little printer.
No, that's true. That's true.
Some people have been criticising this for being wasteful in a time when we're kind of moving away from paper. What do you think about
that? Yeah, that was my first thought as well, because we're sort of all accustomed to, at the end of emails, please think of trees before printing this email.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hate those and I refuse to have one on my own signature, but it's... I kind of think that is an issue. Like, do you need to print this tweet?
Well, no, you don't need to. You don't need this in your life, full stop.
But then think of the number of receipts you get. It is on receipt paper. So it's not, we're not talking huge, bulky
A4
print-offs. It's very small. It's very thin. And I think there's something quite delightful, and maybe I'm just being nostalgic, but something delightful about in this world where everything is digitized. Like you, I think, Duncan, you mentioned, why isn't it not just an app that it will send you? But that's kind of defeats the object for me. It's the crossing over from the digital world into the physical world that makes it so sweet and magical. I think
what I really like about it, what makes it kind of sweet and magical to me, is the snackiness of it.
Yeah.
The fact that you're getting these little tidbits of information, and I like the idea of detaching the content from the delivery mechanism.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of having a little app instead of a little printer. That
so you can have both.
So you could have both, and like the app is maybe free, and you can press the button, and it will, you know, on your screen, and it will deliver all the updates that you haven't seen. So if you forget to press the button and leave your printer out at home, you can do that.
Yeah.
But
what are the content sources? While we're
There are all kinds of things. I think there was a deal with Nike. There was a deal with...
there are Twitter as well. You can do Twitter. That would be the use that I would particularly
like. And there
was
news, and was there not a little kind of puzzles?
Launch partners were Arup, Foursquare, Google, The Guardian, and Nike. And so there was kind of lots of stuff you can do with it. But the interesting thing is you can actually code for it yourself. You can develop for your platform. It's a completely open platform. You've got 60 days or 59, 58 days now by this point, or 57 by the time you listen to this. There's a document on there on the Berg Cloud website which details exactly what you need to develop for this. I just like the idea of having these little snacky things that you can take away as you leave the house or get on your phone or whatever, and doesn't take long to read, but it still delivers a useful amount of information, you know, headlines, weather, that's it.
I'd like to link it up to Twitter and have it pull from a specific hashtag. You know, something that maybe a lot of people would occasionally use and not really think about it, like word of the day as a hashtag, or quote as a, you know, a lot of people do tweet stuff and they will put a hashtag in there and you sort of think, no, you don't really need a hashtag, but people do. And there are some really quite amusing ones.
I tell you what it reminds me of. Do you remember when we went to that Wikipedia, was it an anniversary party you went to? And they had this installation on the ceiling. They had a whole load of these receipt printer machines.
Yeah.
And it printed off a little receipt every time someone updated Wikipedia, or at least it said it was doing it every time. I don't know if it was. So down to the floor fell like kind of confetti, these little pieces of paper, and you'd pick them up and it would be someone had edited the village in Wales where so-and-so, which footballer, was born. And it was quite nice as a kind of keepsake from that event, as a kind of temporary installation.
It was great. Actually, I remember by the time you left the event, it was their 10th anniversary.
Yeah.
By the time you left... the floor was littered with these little pieces of paper, but it had all this bit of metadata on it that was great. I've took some photos of that, actually.
It gives a nice kind of visual impression of the sheer volume of data that is flowing through these servers that you don't really think about. Yeah. It's really nice to see that visualized.
Well, if you do want to order one, search Little Printer on wired.co.uk and you will find our story and all the details you need. Liv, I've always wondered what it would be like if I walked into a bar and a camera was pointing at me and it took my photo and automatically checked me in to that bar on Facebook.
Well, now you can do that, Nate.
Shocking.
This is a little trial by an ad agency in Nashville called Red Pepper. And they've created a system that lets you check in on Facebook using your face.
This face that I have here on
your
my head.
Your actual face. So this requires a few things in advance of this happening. This isn't going to suddenly start automatically happening wherever you go. First of all, the shop or any venue can needs to get a camera with some facial recognition software. Secondly, you as a person need to consent to having your face recognized when you go into a certain establishment. Mm. And then once you've done that and they've done that, when you walk into that establishment, be it a coffee shop or a bar, the camera will spot your face and automatically check you in and then offer you, maybe text you a deal or some kind of loyalty card deal or something like that.
I like it. I've come up with a problem though.
What's your problem?
I know how to break this.
Take photos of people.
No, what if I'm a twin?
I don't actually facial recognition with twins. I don't know how well it distinguishes between them.
Me neither. You would need additional information.
We could ask the listeners if they know anything about it.
Yeah.
What about biometric passports when you look into, if you're an identical twin?
podcast.word.co.uk.
Maybe there are very subtle differences. I don't know about how sophisticated this particular facial recognition is.
I would wonder what would happen if I walked in with like a Bilardi mask.
Yeah. or you just get your friends to all take your photo in and you can rinse the system, man. But anyway, this is just a little trial they're doing. I'm sure people would generally freak out about this from a privacy perspective if it became widespread. But I think it's a really interesting idea. I personally find the annoying thing about checking in is that you always forget to check in. It's Foursquare I signed up to and then always forgot to do it.
Well, I came up with a system for me. I check in on Foursquare for anything work related.
Yeah.
Like if I'm at an event, because that goes out on Twitter and I think most of my followers are probably like industry people or whatever. And I use Facebook for anything that I'm doing that's just personal.
Mm.
And it does help sort of divide.
But how do you remember when you walk in?
Yeah, that's...
Has it just become a habit?
I think I'm just really narcissistic. And so I just think, oh, I must tell everyone that I am here. And so I do.
Fair enough.
Good.
You know? You don't know. That's the problem.
No.
Okay, well, I mean, I don't know whether this is a good thing or not. I think it certainly takes out this stress of remembering to tell people where you are.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think there are some things that need to be ironed out. Twin support.
Let's say.
And
if you do notice anything about twin support on facial recognition, then do drop us a line because I'd be really curious to find out about that.
podcast@wired.co.uk. We've got one more story to get to. I'm just talking about creepiness. A team from the University of Birmingham has just won Nokia's mobile data challenge with an algorithm that, get this, Duncan and Liv and everyone, claims to be able to predict where you will be in 24 hours.
I just got that.
Not just in 24 hours, though.
No, well, this is the thing. What it does is it actually looks at where the location of your friends are and tries to sort of pass that with where you are and come up with a prediction for where you're going to be as a result of those two factors.
So by looking at kind of your movements combined with the movements of other people, it works out where you're going.
Yeah, basically. And the thing is, I mean, there have been systems that can detect, they can predict your own movement. Because most people, you know, if you think about the average person, you know, working 9 to 5, Dolly Parton style, you pretty much know that they're going to go from this house to that station, they're going to get out at that station to that office and go there for lunch and back. And so a system can pretty accurately tell where you're going to be in, say, 3 weeks' time.
So it can model your routines.
It models your routines, but this system...
Rather than your movement.
Can factor in where your friends are as well and try and work out, you know, where you're going to be. And they've had limited success accuracy-wise, but they've managed to get it to within like 20 meters, I think, of where you're going to be.
How is that limited success? That's amazing success.
But it only worked 20% of the time, I think.
Okay.
And so like...
Well, no. I don't think they actually spoke about probabilities. It wasn't that it worked 20% of the time.
It was just the problem.
They sometimes got it to within 20 meters. They didn't... They kind of announced this at... I think they won a prize, I think it was.
It was a Nokia big data thing.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But they didn't actually sort of say that, yeah, we were, you know, 80% of the time we were in 20 meters. And I can't believe that 100% of the time they were within 20 meters.
I don't believe anything could be that accurate.
No, exactly.
Unless they pick the time when you're commuting, in which case I would say that's the only time that I would regularly do the same.
But yeah, I mean, what they were boasting about is that it actually copes very well with breaks in routine. So if you do something that is out of the ordinary, they can still predict that to quite a high degree of accuracy.
Okay.
I think that's why it's particularly impressive. But as I say, they didn't talk about probabilities and their percentage success rates and stuff like that.
That's the problem. I mean, you wrote this story, and one of the things you pointed out is that this could be a gift to advertisers.
Oh, massively.
And I think that has got to be, the worst possible thing to get an advert about. We have detected, by tracking you and your friends, that you might be passing our store tomorrow where we've got a sale on. I would never ever go to that shop again.
Well, I think it would probably be a little more subtle than that. It would probably be more like, here's an advert for McDonald's, just because it knows that you're going to be next to a McDonald's, you know, within lunchtime tomorrow.
What I'm not clear on at this point is what data are they using in terms of the tracking data? Is it just your phone signal? Is it
It's GPS.
It's your location. It's the location of where all your friends are.
But how are they tracking all of those? Is it from at the network level?
This is a hypothetical test, but I mean, most smartphones have GPS in them, and there are lots of systems like Find My Friends on the iPhone or Google Latitude, stuff like that, where it knows where all these phones are using GPS at any given time.
So the idea that you'd have to have all these sorts of services enabled in order to then have this sort of level of accuracy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Nokia thing, so you can imagine theoretically that this would be something they built into Nokia phones.
Yeah.
You would enable it on your friends. Real world uses, is it really that much use, particularly if it's not massively accurate? I don't know. If I was an advertiser, I wouldn't be thinking this is the next big thing in targeted social advertising.
Be getting excited, but I think there is that creep factor that is always a danger, and they have to kind of walk that line quite carefully.
I don't know. I think we sort of get over the creep factor eventually. All the time, you know, we come out and the first response is, for a lot of people, quite knee-jerk. You know, it's the posting stuff in your feed automatically, or it's Twitter showing you ads based on, you know, companies you or your friends follow. And there are these little things that, to begin with, seem a bit creepy, but eventually you just get really completely used to them. Like, it's not creepy if you load up a map on your phone and it knows where you are. If you don't understand what GPS is, I don't think you'd be that creeped out.
No, I don't think knowing where you are, but then having a brand using that information to predict where you might be tomorrow, I think that's a step that, you know, of course, you're actively, you know, pressing a button on a map.
I wonder if there's a kind of like an analogue to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle here. If it tells you that it thinks you're going to be in this place, will you go out of your way to avoid that place?
That would be interesting.
That would be a very interesting bit of research to do.
Yeah, that could be. I like it. This has got into more of a theoretical debate than we sort of anticipated. But let us know, would you be creeped out? Would you like it? podcast@wired.co.uk, of course. And on that note, as I chuck my notes into the middle of the desk, we're going to end the show. Liv, tell us how to get in touch with me and you.
With all of us.
And Duncan.
Duncan for 1 week only. Yeah. You can get us on Twitter.
Send your tearful goodbyes.
Yeah. Here's a box of tears. Tweet it at WiredUK. Or you can go to our Facebook page. You can write a note. You can photograph it. Paste it to our Facebook wall. Facebook.com/WiredUK.
I've just come up with a really good idea that we didn't talk about ever.
What?
The people should send in photos or drawings or poems or something about Duncan leaving, and we'll pick the best one and we'll give away some stuff. We have got cupboards full of stuff.
We've got some good stuff.
We've got some great stuff. Do that. podcast@wired.co.uk. We'll pick a winner for Duncan's leaving show.
I mean, that hoofcast picture we got was pretty fantastic.
I've always wanted to look like a unicorn.
Yeah.
Always. Do that anyway. Just decided.
Great. Okay. And you can also call us on Skype if you wanted to. Wired UK podcast. It's free. Send us a message.
Sing me a song.
Sing Duncan a song.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Bonus points for musical creations. That would be good too.
Or weather creations.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
So
that'd
get
be
that
lovely.
Silver iodide out and
win some of Duncan's gear as he leaves.
Is that what you're going to call this competition?
Yes. It's the Duncan's gear competition of the year.
Lovely.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Walnuts, almonds, hazelnuts, a couple of Brazils.
couple of Brazils. Okay.
That's nuts.